Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Svetlana, you just go ahead. I have to pick something here.
Sure. So welcome to everyone. Good morning, afternoon, and evening. And to our viewers from the Far East, good night. So you are at the ninth episode of Swiss Impact with Banerjee's, meaning myself and Ben. Ben is a little bit busy with something, so I just welcome you instead.
Exactly. So, like Svetlana said, welcome.
Yeah. For the newcomers, I'd like just quickly share that this program we created to share with the world the fastest growing and the best businesses of the future of the time. It's impact investing sector, which we are going to talk about it. And it's not only for the converted ones, the one who already know what is impact investing, right? So our goal is also to get into action unconverted. So, and we have a lot of stories to share about transformative journeys of non-sustainable companies which could take in action and transform their businesses and generate positive social and environmental impact. Ben, you are amazing storyteller. And maybe let's start with some news on the topic, what's happening around the world in impact investing and the related topics. What could you tell our audience?
There are a couple of points I want to go, but the first most is, I don't know if many of you saw the speech of Sir Attenborough to the United Nations a couple of days back, and he focused on the climate change, which is also one of my topics. And what he mentioned is quite disturbing. He said that there's an unprecedented threat which the mankind has never, ever faced before. The threat is impacting the whole globe, and we cannot hide from it in one part of the world or other. Like today you mentioned, why don't we go to the Nordics and stay there? Unfortunately, it won't help. The rising global temperature has already started impacting our food security, loss of the ocean life, which we are all aware of, and what he thinks and what he predicts also, which is backed with the scientific numbers, that this will mean a couple of cities will be drowned and we will end up exterminating many creatures and many life forms from the world who share this world with us. And this is not going to happen in the end of the century or something. This is going to happen in the coming few years, in very short years. And this would also further escalate into collapse of our cities and civilizations by the time our children grow up. So that is in the lifetime of our kids, which is also not very far away from here. And this has already started. So it is not that this is going to be something happening in the future, but this has already started, and it is impacting the poor and the most vulnerable in the world already in these points. Our securities are impacted, food production, access to safe drinking water, habitable temperature, and even ocean food chain. And what he said, that when the natural world fails or cannot fulfill our basic needs, then the civilization collapses. So climate change is the biggest threat that we have ever faced, in as per his words. And he also mentioned that today what we are not aware of is that there's more CO2 in the atmosphere than it has been for millions of years. So with the sound of warning.
Wow. I should next time specialize what I mean by news, maybe good news, you know, especially for the ones who are new. So Ben is known for amazing facts from the world. Sometimes it's very depressing, but they are true. So we need to know about the current state. But maybe you've seen that I was kind of smiling all the time when he was saying these depressing facts. Maybe because Martin Palmer is coming back today to the second episode. So I'm very happy about that. But let me also say some good news, what is happening beside this, what Ben said. So as climate action is accelerating and the world emerges from the shadow also of the COVID pandemic, governments and businesses and the financial world are refocusing on the greatest threat to the well-being of humanity and to the ecosystem on which we depend. And there are amazing initiatives out there which are already happening in order to create positive impact on our planet, I mean, social and environmental impact. Which are those? Now, let me just name a few of them. So, for example, Climate Action 100+, the Net Zero Asset Managers Initiative, the United Nations convened Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, the UNFCCC convened Race to Zero, the Investors Agenda, the Initiative of Climate International, Investor Decarbonization Initiative, of course, the Paris Aligned Investment Initiative, and so on. So it's not the only ones which are happening. So we are keeping our show positive because we believe that impact investing is the future and that we have all the resources available, all the technology available, all money in the world available in order to overcome the challenges which are out there, and they are represented by Sustainable Development Goals defined by United Nations. And I'd like to end up this positive news with a quote from Mark Carney. The financial sector and the investment community will play a central role in the global response to climate change and supporting the transition to a net zero economy.
Exactly. So I would say absolutely the businesses, please watch out and adapt. Like Charles Darwin once said, it's not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent, but the ones which are most responsive to change.
Exactly. And now we can show the slide again. So for this purpose, exactly for that purpose, we are continuing on the training course which we started for entrepreneurs and startups, where we answer such questions like how to create successful and meaningful business, which is not only creating high returns, but also solves social and environmental issues. Meanwhile, right? So how to structure and scale your business, how to successfully fundraise, because everyone is looking for funds, in the impact investing sector. So we are opening the doors to this impact investing sector to all entrepreneurs which would like to create both income, returns, and social and environmental impact. So, and our next event is actually on the 18th of March. If you didn't make a picture, you just can go to chamomile.ch. It's a platform and two events, and then you can register to the course.
Exactly. And of course, the event is just a start. We support also all ideas and businesses with structuring, business development, and of course, with fundraising and investor selection as per our mentorship program. So with this, we welcome you all to join the program whenever you want. And just about our own family program, which we do every Friday here, the show is about impact investment, for which we interview business, political, financial, and thought leaders from all over the world.
And the speaker of today, the ones who missed the first part, please check online. It's also available, the recording. He represents asset owners who are large enough to finance most of sustainable development goals all alone. So he was here 2 weeks ago, but we couldn't complete all the interview and all the questions. It was so inspiring. So we demanded him to come back to answer the rest of the questions. So you have the chance to put your questions in the chat as well. And we continue the journey on impact investing on this Fate Invest.
Exactly. So with this, we once again welcome Martin Palmer, the president and interim CEO of Faith Invest.
Welcome, Martin.
Martin, you nearly gave me a heart attack again.
Yes, I know. Well, I thought, you know, I would just stretch your confidence and faith by yet again almost completely failing to get in. I have to say, your colleague...
Martin, I believed you will come.
Well, I think that Ankit may need some special treatment after having to deal with me once again. But here I am, and thank you for inviting me back for another session of the Svetlana Tortoise Chamber. I look forward to it as always. Seriously,
thank you, Martin. For all the viewers who haven't met you yet, can you just give a short background, of your background and the origin of the Faith Invest?
Yes,
and the activities of it.
Yes. I'm probably a moderately unusual guest for your esteemed program in that I'm a theologian, a religious studies expert, and one of the very few non-Chinese who can still translate classical Chinese for publication and interpretation. I'm a specialist in world religions. For many, many, many years, for 36 years, I've been Prince Philip's religious advisor on the environment, and with him created the whole rollout of programs around the world with the major faiths on the environment, developing environmental programs based on their own teachings, their own practice, their own assets. And when I started in this work back in 1985 with Prince Philip, we sort of thought of the faiths as being useful groups that can bring pressure on governments, on international agencies, multinationals, and so on and so forth, but also as groups that had their own core values in a world which even then was fairly thin on core values. Over the years, and particularly since I was the editor of the first ever State of Religion Atlas that looked at the politics, what were the majority religions in each country? What were their links with political structures? What was their role in education? Their issues on gender, their investments, environment. That's shifted because we began to appreciate through a survey that we did around about 2000, the extent to which the faiths are stakeholders in the planet. They run 50% of all schools or are involved with 50% of all schools. According to UNICEF, 64% of all schools in sub-Saharan Africa. They run a third of all higher education institutions, universities, colleges, and the such like, more than a third of all medical facilities that, of course, have become so hugely important under COVID are run by faiths around the world. And they are the third largest investing group in the world. And way back in 2001, we first started working with the faith investment groups, saying to them, you've got these core values, how are you putting them into practice? Mm-hmm. And many of them were not actually even doing negative screening then. They might have a historical negative screening, such as, Islam has a ban on usury, although that only really came back in 1973 with the first...
Martin, just for our audience, the ones who are not familiar with negative screening, meaning that you exclude some of your out of your investment scope, some companies like tobacco industry, alcohol, gambling, pornography, whatever it is. So you put some criteria and exclude. So this is negative screening. Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Hold on. Thank you. For many faiths, those were based on what they believed. So for example, with the faiths that banned the taking of any life, any form of life, certain forms of Hinduism, Jainism, and so forth, that then affected what they would invest in. And then we were asked by the United Nations in 2015 to bring together the major religions with the major sections of the UN to look at the SDGs. And out of that, there became an awareness in the UN that the faiths were massive investors. They had not really taken on board the stakeholder role of the faiths. And we were asked to create a white paper for the United Nations and for OECD. That then led to bringing together the major religions in Zug, courtesy of SIA, the Swiss Impact Investing Association, who have been one of our major partners all along, which is how we got to know Svetlana and Ben. And from that emerged a working group in collaboration with the UN to create a new organization that would actually help the faiths do what they should have been doing anyway, which is to be faith consistent in their investing, because the money that the faiths gain from their investments is what maintains the mosques, the synagogues, the churches, the temples. It maintains the schools, it maintains the hospitals. Mm-hmm. It pays for the welfare, it pays for doing the rites of passage, it pays for the great festivals, it pays for some of the most magnificent buildings in the world to be kept standing. But there was a gap between how they got the money, where the money came from, and what they did with it. Mm-hmm. That gap was basically that the faiths were not being faith consistent in investing in line with their values. And so Faith Invest was brought into being at the request of the major faiths in 2019 to help the faiths move into being faith consistent, move their investments into investing in environmental and sustainable projects. And that's why we're also busy creating pipelines of investable projects, why we're very interested in the work that SIA does and that you're doing in highlighting that where are these projects that could be invested in by the faith because they match the values, the teachings, the beliefs of the faiths. So,
okay. On a very serious note, Martin, you mentioned King Philip's or Prince with whom you have been working, but were you aware that the British royal family is Indian?
India. Oh, I'm so sorry. Just bear with me. Can you hear that terrible noise?
Yeah, we do.
Now it's stopped.
It was maybe just to skip your question, Ben, you know?
Exactly.
To have some time to think what to answer for that.
This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about next week.
I'm very sorry, very sorry. Oh, yeah. Somebody was drilling outside the house. I've stopped it. Sorry, you were saying, yes, the Indian roots of the... I mean, I know that Queen Victoria was the Empress of India.
Exactly. She was the Empress of India. They all live in the same family house till they get married. Most of them have arranged marriage. And they all work in the family business. You can't be more Indian than that.
I walked straight into that one, didn't I? I absolutely walked straight into that. Thank you very much indeed.
And now on a lighter
in the program.
And now on a lighter note, yes. You mentioned about the investment requirements or the values. But for example, the United Nations came up with the SDGs. They are promoting SDG everywhere. But if you look at their own pension fund, which is like 80 billion plus, they are not really very SDG aligned with their pension plans. Same is also with, for example, the Bishop of Cologne, which is one of the most asset-rich bishopdoms. But if you look at their investment criteria, it's not really very aligned with the Christian beliefs and Christian faith.
No.
So how are you promoting that?
You've touched why Faith Invest exists. There has mm-hmm. been a gap between the language and the action. And I could say to give you exactly the same example for most of the major environmental organizations, that they're very good at telling other people what to do, but not very good at doing it themselves. For example, one major environmental group that we've worked with for years, who've been great supporters of the work with the faiths, had no ethical purchasing policy until we, after mm-hmm. about 20 years of badgering them, said, how can you talk about a sustainable planet and not be sourcing the food that you serve in your building to so many people? So, yeah, I mean, in a sense, what we've seen is a drift between where the money has come from and who manages it. And in many cases, the actual management staff within the major organizations like the United Nations or within the major religious organizations has diminished. It's become very small because they've outhoused to fund managers. And the fund managers basically have been told your only real responsibility is to maximize return. That's your only fiduciary responsibility as trustees, is to give us as much money as possible, as clean as possible, hence the next screening. But even that, I mean, in 2001, I reckon less than 20% of religious investments had a negative screening program. It was that poor. So part of what we're doing in Faith Invest is actually helping to develop a cadre, a group of fund managers who get that actually there has to be a correlation between the values and the practice. And the fact that we have to exist to make that happen shows how much of a drift there has been away from the religious values and the actual practice. And yeah, I mean, we have a phrase that we use with our faiths, which is, first of all, practice what you want to preach, and then preach about what you practice. And that, I think, could be applied to any organization that claims to some degree the moral high ground is, don't tell other people what to do until you're doing it yourself.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Exactly. And I'm looking forward to some inspiring preachers today as well, as last show, Martin. But, you know, it's so true with also United Nations. I also met them, and the organization is huge, right? So you meet one and another. I also had a meeting with some of the big guys on the United Nations in Geneva, and they admitted, yeah, indeed, we don't invest as per SDGs ourselves, even though they defined it, right? So how do you kind of quicken up this process of aligning the values and shifting assets? What is the process? How long does it take Faith Invest to go there to talk to them that really the action happens not in 3 years, but now?
Good, very good question indeed. And I mean, essentially, that was the first question we had to answer. How do we create a process where we reconnect faith with its values and teachings, with what it does with its, not just its financial assets either, its land, its buildings, its influence, its power. And we do this in a very simple way. The great thing about the faiths, unlike the United Nations, is that you can go back to core texts within every major faith that tell you what they believe. And so the first task we do, any group that wants to join us, and we did this when we did the first meeting in Zug, and in fact, this whole process is called Zug Guidelines. Each faith group, and we're not talking about the whole of Christianity, we're talking about the Church of England, the Church of Sweden, the Orthodox Church of Constantinople, the Vatican, the religious orders, each one of them, we say to them, okay, what do you believe? What is it that you actually believe? Why are we here? Why was the world created? What is our role here? How do we deal with failure and weakness and foolishness and sin, whatever phrase you want to use, because whatever we do, it's always imperfect because we're human beings. So how do you deal with imperfection? How do you deal with aspiration? How do you deal with education and teaching? From that, we then say, okay, these are your core beliefs. And for some faiths, it is that we are called to be stewards of the planet. And it is to be the khalifas, the governors of the planet. For others, is to find our place within the circle of life and to recognize that we are but a part of something much bigger. So define that. Then we say, so given those teachings, what are the values that emerge from that? Detail the core values. Core values in terms of relationship, well, there are four that the major faiths would all recognize. One is, what is your relationship with the divine? However you understand that, whether that's God or the gods or the Tao, whatever it is, what is your relationship with the greater story? Mm-hmm. The second relationship is, what is your relationship with the rest of life on earth? Third one is, what is your relationship, and this is very much using Jesus's words, with your neighbor, given that his view of the of your neighbor was probably the people you most least like. In other words, it's the whole world, including the really nasty people like Ben, who make a joke right at the beginning of the TV program that I go straight into, but I forgive him, you see? So you've got that thing. And the final one is your relationship with yourself. And I think an awful lot of groups that are very caring are very good at the first three, but they forget the one about the relationship with yourself. If you are not honest with yourself, then the rest of those relationships are not true. And that's really what we're pushing for. What is it that your values actually tell you should do? From that, we then say to them, okay, how is that reflected in your investing policy in terms of negative investing? Svetlana, thank you for that brilliant description of what that means. And then finally, given that's what you're against, what are you for? And a very interesting example of that would be that everybody knows about Sharia law, this idea within Islam that there is a series of teachings that say what is not permissible, which brings the Islamic teaching of the ban on usury, and obviously, you know, other key areas of Islamic faith, what you cannot do. We're now working with a fascinating group of Muslim scholars and investors and saying, okay, if Sharia tells you what you cannot invest in, what is haram, as it's called, then presumably, if it isn't banned, it's legal. So we're then saying, stop telling us what you won't invest in and then just investing in a boring way. Recognize that Islamic finance alone could shift the entire financial market if it decided what it was going to invest in order to create the kind of world we want to live in. The same is true with the Vatican, and we're in the process of devising with colleagues a Vatican policy on precisely that as well. So I don't know if that answers the question.
No, there's
a logic. There is a logic, Svetlana, how we get the face to recognize.
But how long in terms of time does it usually take? Like when
About 18 months.
18 months?
18 months.
Oh my gosh, it's quite long.
Well, not really, because although most people think that most religions are run by popes, there is only the Catholic Church that is run by a pope. Surprisingly, most religious organizations are, if not fully democratic, are quasi-democratic and have consultative processes by which decisions are made, because there is a great danger in giving total power to a religious or a political leader. And over the centuries, the faiths have evolved mechanisms for accountability. And those take time. And also, if you want the decision to be real, what you don't want is a religious leader who goes to a conference and says, yes, we will invest ethically, and then goes home and forgets all about it. What you want is that the people who manage the finances have been told this is what they must do, because the structure that is responsible for telling them what they should do for investments has told them that this is the new policy and has said, and we back this with resources, with staffing, and so forth, because the faiths are enormously powerful and complex organizations. And in the same way that you would not expect BP to be able to change within a fortnight, you would expect, well, if we look at the way that BP has taken the time it's taken to start rethinking its policy on fossil fuels and alternative energies, I think the faiths are way ahead. I mean, you know, they're racing ahead in comparison.
Yeah, that's very true. Coming to that, I wanted to ask that since we are now in the midst of this pandemic going on and how, you know, things are changing as everything appraises, so where would your effort be for this year, for this 2021? And what are the sectors you will be looking into? I mean, for example, would you be looking into climate action, forestry, renewable energy? So how would you be operating this year?
Very good question indeed, Ben. We have a whole process called Faith Long-Term Plans. And we first did this with the UN back in 2008, 2009, and culminated in a big ceremony at Windsor Castle with Ban Ki-moon and with Prince Philip, at which 64 major faiths said, these are the priorities that we will now focus on for the next 10 years. Because of all the chaos around COP 26 at Glasgow being postponed, we were approached about this time last year and asked by the UN and the British government, obviously hosting the conference, the COP, could we mobilize the faiths to become an alternative powerhouse driving change, hopefully to support the national government decisions in saying, great, you're doing it, we're doing it also. If the national governments fail, as they did at Copenhagen in 2009, then there is an alternative. We do not put all our eggs into the basket of nation states. There's a very, very good phrase in the Book of Proverbs in the Hebrew Bible, which says, "Put not your trust in princes." Well, I've applied that with Prince Philip, but if you take it to a broader principle of governments, you know, basically, don't put your trust in governments. and advice that goes back about 3,000 years, worth listening to, I think. So we have, so we started this program of saying to the faiths, these are the seven areas we want you to asset and audit, because many faiths don't know how much they own, don't know how many schools they have, don't know how many money they have, don't know how much land they've
got. It usually happens when you have too much, you know, when you have just very little things, very little account, you count every cent. But this is a luxury not to know how much I have.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're quite right. And so there are seven areas. There's assets, which is buildings, land, investments. There's education, which is the schools, but also the youth movement, the faiths. Are involved in four out of the six largest youth organizations in the world, which have 300 million young people in them. It's an enormous impact. Then there's lifestyles. Then there's wisdom. We have a great wisdom within the faiths about how to run the world. We've done it moderately successfully up until about 200 years ago. And then there's areas like media and advocacy, partnerships, celebration. But what we're actually saying to the faiths is, right, by the time we get to the end of September, I'm getting an echo back, by the way, I don't know if you are.
Yeah, I'm also getting a bit of echo.
Yes, that's better. I think, oh no, I'm still getting an echo back.
I don't have echo.
Okay.
Oh, then it's only Martin and me. It must be limited to men.
We'll draw whatever conclusions from that we feel is necessary, Ben, right? So we launched this initiative about 8 months ago and said to the major faith traditions, right, we want you to audit what you've got. We want you to make actual commitments that can be quantified so that we know that if you're going to make a commitment to move your investments, if you're going to make a commitment to green your energy or whatever it is, we track it. We now, and so remember, there were 64 such plans in 2009. We're now looking at up to 1,400 plans, 1,400 different religious organizations saying, this is what we will commit to and how it will work. And what is emerging from that is really interesting. The key areas, and these will be our key areas for investment, our key areas for seeking pipelines of projects, are water, energy, food, transport, housing. Those are the five key areas. Across that, we have sort of cross-cutting themes like climate change and biodiversity. But basically, it's very interesting. If you look at the core teachings of the Buddha about what you need as a minimum, but not as an excess, to live well, it is those areas. You need water to drink. You need food to eat. You need clothes to keep you warm. You need somewhere to rest your head. And you need the ability and the freedom to travel. Ironically, 2,500 years after the Buddha delineated that, that is precisely what the faiths are saying they need to enable and ensure through their investments.
I think we also need nature.
Well, that's biodiversity.
Now I got echo.
Now we all have echo.
Oh, do you? I don't have an echo.
No, you don't. We are the only two.
Well, there we go. So, sorry, Svetlana, you said...
Nature.
That's the biodiversity. That's the phrase that the environmental world uses for that. So, yes, the two overarching themes. Well, actually, I would say three, to be more honest. And they're summed up very well in the Pope's declaration in Laudato Si, where he says we have to care for people and the planet. And there has traditionally been more of a focus in Western faiths on caring for people than there has been for caring for the rest of life on the planet. We have had to learn that from the more Eastern traditions, who see us as part of a bigger web rather than masters of the universe or whatever we want to phrase we want to give ourselves. So yes, nature, biodiversity, terrible phrase. When people started using biodiversity, I said, oh, you mean lots of nature? And they went, oh, yes, I suppose so.
Exactly. Yeah. And do you think that the faiths are also evolving as a result of that pandemic? I mean, going more from spiritual to social and economical aspects.
Well, I think they were always there. And one of the big mistakes of the SDGs was to pretend that it was only the UN that had noticed that education and health were important issues. Every major faith in the world has focused on education and health since their inception. All the major hospitals and schools of the world began within the faiths. No one else was doing this. So that was terribly patronizing. I think the main shift that has happened has been a realization of the degree to which the faiths have accidentally become complicit in the very forces that we have seen so starkly highlighted by the iniquities and the inequalities and the failures that the COVID crisis has spotlighted for us. As you know, I'm a member of the Pope's COVID Commission, and that was able to build on two earlier encyclicals by the Pope, letters, authoritative letters, which is what an encyclical is. One is Laudate Si, which is the one on the environment, but the predecessor to that was Evangelii Gaudium, his massive critique of humanist capitalism. And to a very great extent, the SDGs are simply a way of trying to keep consumerist capitalism going without killing everything. Mm-hmm. It's not a fundamental challenge to the fact that it's a very, very, very bad model to work from in the first place.
Exactly.
But this is also like in impact investing, you know, some companies are becoming very successful and they scale and scale and scale. But how I see that even in impact investing, you should stop at some point, right? Mm. It's not the idea that then you consume sustainable products all over the world and we continue running this consumption model. Even though it's sustainable, still people should realize that we should not overconsume even those products in impact investing space.
I mean, concrete example will be palm oil.
But, yes.
Very good alternative to everything, but now we are destroying forests and everything to create more and more palm oil because the demand is ever increasing.
Absolutely, you're quite right. And I think that's striking the balance. I mean, we had a very interesting, we're working with a fascinating group called the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative, which is working in Peru, Colombia, Brazil, the Congo, and Indonesia. And they're kind of almost the other side of the problem. They were doing some extraordinarily good work, are doing extraordinarily good work on protecting the forests. And in particular, they have this wonderful sort of mantra where they say, look, to protect the forest, protect the people of the forest, which in many cases are indigenous communities. If they're protected, the forest is protected. And we've been in conversation with them over the last year about how we could work together. And the fascinating thing was that they had thought through how to preserve the forest, but they hadn't thought through, so how do you ensure that the local people who you want to protect are actually able to earn an income that gives them a decent style of life? And so we've been coming at it almost from the other side. We've been saying, okay, let us help you to identify sustainable projects using forest products that sustain and support the forest, but that would include, would ensure that the local people don't kind of slump back to either being sort of almost zoo exhibits in a forest for tourists, or are left in poverty even if they've still got the forest. So that balance of discovering how to make something sustainable so that local people and communities can live, without turning it into a kind of vast multinational that loses sight of its principles, which has happened to a certain extent with all the major organizations. So there was a wonderful book called Small is Beautiful that was written back in the 70s. And I think that's the theme we need to remember. Small is beautiful. And part of what we're focusing on are small and medium scale projects. And we like... Now, the problem with small and medium scale projects, and many of your people, I suspect, will be in that category.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. I've got entrepreneurs who are planning to want a $5 billion investment plan within the first year. We are supporting the small and medium scale by bringing together small and medium scale and large scale religious investment creating a basket of projects at say sort of 20 or 30 million, but with maybe 15 or 20 different projects that are then administered as a block. The danger of it then being taken over is a very real danger. And that again takes us back to, well, what are the core values? Why are you doing this? Are you doing it because you want to be of service to a community? So if you look at the B Corp world is huge in terms of the scale and the potential for investment projects that they can do. If you're looking instead for setting up your own, you know, Google size thing, then this is not the world for you to be in. So sorry, just one moment.
Of course.
Sorry, one moment.
No problem.
This is interesting what he's mentioning because I was just thinking, this is exactly what our course is about, educating the small and the medium enterprises on how to function, how to set up, and how to fulfill all the requirements for these kind of investors. That's basically, he's just strengthening our whole point. And that's what, it was a very, very good point to jump into, that on one side you have the impact investors or these big funds and who have a lot of money to invest, but they are speaking about huge amounts. And on the other side you have the small businesses, small enterprises whose demands and requests are so small that they have to do it properly before coming, making a demand or making an question to that. Martin, something completely off the hype. How do you say? What would you think if all the religious leaders today come out and say to their believers, to their followers, that please take care of the environment, please take care of your surrounding, please treat the place you live or the world you live in with love? I mean, I'm sure more people will be affected and will listen than to Donald Trump, most certainly.
I hope so. They already have. I mean, one of the great sort of unknown secrets or lost or hidden secrets of the world is that the fact that faiths, back in 2009, the UN described the religious programs on the environment as being the largest civil society movement on the environment in the world. We have over 3.5 million faith-based environmental projects at local churches, mosques, schools, as well as international programs. It's just that the faiths get on with it rather than strut around as an awful lot of other organizations do, proclaiming what they're doing. But every major religion has produced a set of core teachings on the environment. Most of them now have environment departments with staff, with expertise, with rollout programs, some more than others. So if we look at the Orthodox churches, for example, they've had a massive program on the environment through all the major Orthodox churches since 1989. Other faiths are still working their way towards this. There is a program at the moment coordinated by United Nations Environment Program, which is bringing together, I think it's 56 Muslim nations, to create a collective Muslim statement. But they came out with a statement on, for example, climate change in 2015, which is really radical and has led already to changes within the investment policy and the energy policy of Saudi Arabia. So it's happening, but it's happening in a way that the faiths know how to do best. We think in generations. Most activist organizations think in 18 months. And what you end up with is a lot of programs that look very good when they're launched and that you hope nobody's going to ask you about at the end of the 18 months because there isn't much to show. Because human nature does not change primarily through threats. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the great problems of the environmental movement has been that we've threatened people. We've tried to scare them into good practice. Now, people will often say, but isn't that what religions have done? No. Of course we've had groups that have become very dramatic and very apocalyptic. But the vast majority of what faiths do is that they walk beside you through the ups and downs of life, through the struggles of life, through the joys of life, For example, I mean, just to take one very simple example, I as you know, Ben, because I sent you my book and you're very nice about it, I actually do a lot about reading religious buildings and landscapes and understanding the sort of subliminal messages that are hidden inside the buildings. And I often say to people, you know, if you want me to read your church, I will read your church, but what it will tell you is that there are something like 7 or 8 different versions of Christianity in this building going back 1,000 years, because it doesn't stay the same, but it evolves in a way that people feel it's still the same. So one of the key things is, if you look at a medieval church anywhere in Europe, it looks like a ship. You've got the tower, and then you've got the body of the church, which narrows down to essentially the prow of the ship. And that's deliberate, because the image of the Christian faith to itself is that we're a ship that will carry you through the storms and through the sailing through this life. It will carry you through the ups and downs. It's somewhere you can go to be protected, and somewhere also that will say, let's journey on. And it's also the boat that will take you into the afterlife. So What we need to recognize is that the way you actually move people is by giving them a structure that gives them the confidence to be themselves, but where you adapt and change slightly every so often so that you are able to steer them to perhaps a slightly different destination. Threats don't achieve that. And I think we commented on this last time, I can't quite remember, but you know, we're constantly being told by the environmental movement and others what we can't do, what we can't eat, what we can't buy, what we can't travel, and so on and so forth. And the faiths all do that. They all have periods. There's Ramadan, we're in the middle of Lent now, of a lockdown. You simplify. But you don't do it for the whole of the year, because the moment you finish Ramadan, you have Eid al-Fitr, and the moment you finish Lent, you have Easter, and we celebrate. And we need that celebratory element. And if there's one thing that the commercial world has learned better than any other agency, is people love to party. And much of consumerism is dedicated to partying. What we need to do is give a sense that you party, but you party because you've already made a difference. That's the part of it, I think.
I have an idea, Nick. Some of the shows we should make a party show. Invite everyone to celebrate.
Absolutely, yes. Bring drinks. In our team, we have a coffee morning on a Monday and an afternoon tea. We are very British.
Some cookies, with some British cookies.
We do not call them cookies, my dear. We
biscuits.
Call them
biscuits.
Mm-hmm. Biscuits. Okay. I'm sorry.
Yes, quite all right. You know, we understand you're not British. You know, we have. It kind of works. You're not allowed to discuss any business in those sessions. And I think in this virtual world, the problem of being able to converse without being serious is a real problem, which is why I tell you lot jokes and you're rude to me. So it works very well.
I'm serious. I never tell a joke.
Yeah, well, that's a joke, isn't it, Ben?
Let's get a bit more serious, because, yeah. I mean, you were talking about indigenous people, and actually I want to ask a question this topic, but then we completely changed direction. But I'd like to go back, because it's a very important topic about indigenous spirituality and knowledge hold when it comes to faith-based efforts, you know. And let me just quickly maybe some current status, like indigenous spirituality and knowledge are widely recognized as pillars of sustainability, and indigenous people are often described as custodians of biodiversity and healthy environment. Yet, indigenous spirituality and knowledge are systematically threatened as indigenous people are killed, tortured, harassed, displaced, and deprived of their essential lands and sources of both material and spiritual wealth. One could say that indigenous faiths are today the ones that suffer most from persecutions, to the point that they are at risk of disappearing due to their strong links with the environment. So how can other faiths and you protect indigenous faiths? And how can faith-consistent investment protect indigenous people and their heritage?
There is a fundamental flaw in that opening sequence where you quoted that they are custodians of their environment. Most of them are not, because they don't believe we're in control. So the language itself is already putting a totally false interpretation on the vast majority of indigenous spirituality. Most indigenous spirituality sees the problem with the idea that somebody owns the forest, for example. One of the really difficult projects that we've had to deal with is that the United Nations launched a thing called RED, which was a whole program for valuing forests as carbon sinks. To value a forest as carbon sinks, I mean, you need to have somebody who has a bank account that you can pay money into so that they don't cut down the forests. Indigenous peoples don't have bank accounts for forests because they don't think they own the forest. They think they are owned by the forest. They don't see it as something that they could hold or control. Right. They see it as something that they are part of. So the very language of that declaration is fundamentally flawed, because that's the exact problem, the Western perception that somebody must own this, even if they own it in a nice way.
They still own it.
That's not how indigenous traditions view their relationship with land or with forests or with water. So there's a fundamental flaw in that very argument. Yep. The strength of indigenous, and let's be frank, most indigenous communities are also deeply involved with either Christianity or Islam, Buddhism or Hinduism. There are almost no communities that do not have a spiritual relationship and a political, social, economic relationship with one of those four major faiths around the world. It's an illusion to think that there are untapped communities that have no links with that. What you get coming out of those are what are called indigenous churches, indigenous Islam, indigenous Buddhism, indigenous Hinduism, which is an amazing fusion between these different worlds that complement each other and have in the past conflicted. I mean, all of those four religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, have been responsible for genocide on different traditions. And, you know, we know about the attitudes of say, the Buddhist rulers within Myanmar, within the Karen communities up in the mountains, which are a combination of Christian and indigenous. They basically tried to wipe them out. So you've got huge problems of attacks on these communities. But to cast them into a Western model that they are owners is to destroy their core spirituality, which is that we are not the owners. We are the guests.
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that completely, that we are the guests.
Yeah. We are the guests. And as guests, you do not trash the house. And that's the difference. And I think we do quite a lot of work with indigenous communities, primarily through the partnerships that they have created with very progressive religious organizations. So, for example, many of the Christian development agencies, like CAFOD or Caritas or Christian Aid or Lutheran World Service, have done a great deal of work of enabling those communities to have a voice. Because we could just kind of seek to represent them, which is the old tradition, or you actually give them the space to have a voice. And if I go back to the Interfaith Rainforest Initiative, one of their great successes is that they have basically handed the project over to local communities in Latin America, to a fusion between Catholic and indigenous communities. And those are the voices that you're hearing. In the Congo, it tends to be a mixture of again, mostly Christian, some Muslim, whereas in Indonesia, it's obviously Muslim. So it's about hearing those voices. And it's then about, and I mentioned this, I referenced this earlier, our danger with indigenous communities, particularly in forests, is that we want to kind of keep them in the forest like an animal in a zoo. Let's preserve the forest, let's leave some people in there, and then we feel as though we're kind of in touch with indigenous spirituality. Well, indigenous spirituality is actually about how the heck do you make sense of this chaotic, weird, strange planet on which we live? And how do you develop a relationship with both its ambiguities and its strengths and its weaknesses? Mm-hmm. Keeping them just, as it were, almost fossilized in a forest is not a natural state. And if you do that, people will rebel. Those of us who are parents know the quickest way to drive a child out of the home when they're old enough to leave is to smother them with too much affection and too many tasks in the house. And then they flee, which is great. So am I too. Wonderfully, they disappear. It's very well. But you know, whereas if we create more of a sense that they can contribute, then they grow to be who they are, but they don't have to fight us. And mm-hmm. I think we've got to be very careful that we don't turn Indigenous peoples into sort of ethnographical fossils.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have a major program working with faith development agencies saying, who are the groups that you're working with, who you currently give grants to, which means they're dependent on you, who could develop a development, an investment program. And Ben, you were touching on the need for due diligence and proper business plans. Let us help those groups to do that by bringing in the expertise they probably don't have on marketing, on media, on branding, on budgeting. Let's bring them in on the infrastructure that they need to build. Let's bring those in, but basically that must be owned by those communities. And that's one of our major priorities for the pipelines, is mm-hmm. letting local communities collectively come together and say, we would be stronger together. I'll give you one example. We're working in southern India through one of the great Hindu temples there. We're looking at creating an investable package for all the different small trades, small artisans, small pilgrim groups, the places that pilgrims stay, the food, the travel. We're working with them to create a whole ecological program that is sustainable because it will earn money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Money needs to be earned in a sustainable environmental way. Collectively, we can then bring investors into that. Individually, they would never get that capital. But yeah. There needs to be a clear principle of why are we doing this? We're not doing this for individual gain. We're doing this on behalf of the community. Back to the B Corp.
And are you aware of international organizations or other power centers doing, or in your opinion, are they doing enough to engage and empower faith-based lenders to generate sustainable impact within their own communities, particularly when these leaders govern the affairs of their communities, including socioeconomic ones?
A good question. When we did the event with the UN on the Sustainable Development Goals and brought the faith together with them at the beginning of 2015, we produced a thing called the Bristol Commitments, which was what the faith said they would particularly engage with in supporting the SDGs, which they didn't support all of them. They didn't feel all of them were necessary for them, but some were highly pertinent. And when we published these reports just before the General Assembly in 2015 that adopted the SDGs, we got a phone call from the United Nations saying, we've just read that 9 out of the 24 faith commitments are looking at moving their investments. Do the faiths have any investments? I mean, the level of ignorance mm-hmm. about yeah. The third largest investing group in the world shows you the problem we're up against. And then the reverse is that when you say to people, you are talking about one third of the world's investments, the third largest investment group in the world, and we have access to most of them, then their eyes open wide and they kind of go, wow, how can we have access to it? And you go, well, it's not quite that simple. But we are working. So I'll give you a very, very good example. We're working with a wonderful person called Mafalda Duarte, who is the head of the World Bank's Climate Investment Fund. A fantastic person, a person who has run an incredibly successful program for 10 years, bringing in state funding supported by World Bank, collaterals, to invest in energy efficiency around the world. And they've been able to sort of put, 10% in, and they get their other 90% from other investors because they've done the due diligence and so forth. Now, they had never thought of working even with the private sector. And they had no idea. Mafalda came to a conference we did just over a year ago, actually, in Geneva, on her way to Davos, and was stunned to hear about the faiths and their finances, and that they were consciously seeking to move into investing. And we had a wonderful conversation afterwards in which she said, well, this is marvelous, you know. Well, your due diligence is marvelous. Look at the projects you're doing. These are exactly the projects we want to be helping our investors to invest in. We're now waiting. We should have, by Monday, a proposal from the World Bank Climate Investment Fund through their lawyers and through Mafalda's guidance on creating a faith investors unit within or beside the World Bank Climate Investment Fund to work specifically on climate investing with the faiths, both on a mega scale, a government level, but also at a more private and commercial level. And with all due respect, for the World Bank to move that fast is quite encouraging. You know, it really is. And I think very much due to the inspiration of Mafalda and of Roland Schwartz, who I believe you met just recently, there's also been inspiration behind that. But we've got other groups. So one of the really fascinating things that's coming out of discussions, for example, the World Resources Institute, probably the foremost sort of science-based targets advisory development structure in the world, had never worked with religions until stumbled across each other, actually, ironically, on the Pope's COVID Commission. And now they are establishing a unit on faith and development within WRI. Which is taking seriously, again, the potential of the faiths, not just as investors, but also as partners in development. But all that has happened, basically, in the last 12 months.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
So there are good, more than straws in the wind. There are kind of haystacks in the wind. But there's a long way to go yet, Ben. You're right. There's a long way to go yet. And there's a long way to go beyond the faith being seen as useful tools for somebody else's agenda rather than actually useful partners because they have their own agenda that chimes in many ways, but not all, with current development values.
Exactly. Okay, yeah, I'd like to ask the following question, Martin. What are the key commonalities and divergences in how different families of religions approach the concept of social and environmental welfare? So does that differ between developed and developing countries somehow?
Well, now there's a nice small question, Svetlana.
now I can see Martin thinking.
We are challenging you today.
Yeah, you are, which is why on again. I knew it would be fun. Okay, very crudely speaking, it falls into two camps, very crudely. Within the Abrahamic faiths, that's within the Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and to a certain extent also the Baha'i faith, there is a sense of corporate responsibility as the human race for the planet in differing ways, very, very differing ways. So you have the straightforward, I've already referenced it, the belief in being caliphs within Islam. This is not our planet, according to Islam. The fall, the biblical fall, was from another planet, which is why you can go to Sri Lanka and see where Adam's foot hit the ground, or if you're very brave, you could go and dig up the Kaaba in Mecca and look for the footprint underneath that. I really wouldn't recommend that. But this, so we're here on trial. We are here to see whether we have grown mature enough to return home by being given the responsibility by God as the caliph, the ruler of the world, to manage this planet for him in the same way that caliphs used to manage elements of, say, the Ottoman Empire on behalf of the caliph. Even within that tradition of the Abrahamic faiths, you have very different notions. So there's a beautiful notion within the Orthodox Church. And within the Orthodox Church, they take seriously that we have this unique position of, and it's beautifully described in the Psalms, the great poems of Judaism from about 3,000 years ago, where it says, "Oh God, you have made us higher than the animals and just slightly lower than the angels." So there is that sense that we have, and of course, also in the Hebrew Bible, you have that Adam names all the animals, and naming in traditional cultures is that you have power. If I couldn't remember Ben's name, and I would want to say, "Well, you know the guy who's to the left of you there, Svetlana, what's his name? Ben, that's right. I've already lost his sense that I'm taking him seriously." So the power of naming is enormous. If you know the name of something, you have a power over it, and it has a power over you as well. Again, famous stories of Jacob wrestling with the angel and so forth in the Hebrew Bible. So within the Orthodox tradition, there is the tradition, yes, we're powerful, but we're only powerful because we are a vessel. We are simply a channel for God's blessing on the earth to all the rest of life on earth, and the ability of the rest of life to give worship back to God. We are not powerful, but we are simply the empty channel, the tube that brings the blessing of God to the earth. Now, that's a very different notion from we're in charge and we can do stewardship and we can run it as we want. So that's within the Abrahamic faith, you have this huge variance. And then really, and I'm going to use a very inadequate term, but within the Vedic traditions, and the Vedic traditions, as Ben knows better than anybody else, those are the traditions that flowed out of the Vedas, which are amongst some of the oldest literature in the world, probably 3,000-4,000 BC, but which then led to the development of what we now call Hinduism, which covers a multitude of varieties, Buddhism, Jainism, and that view is that we are part of a cycle. Any power we have is usually illusionary, and that actually in the end, this is a world of great uncertainties, whereas the Abrahamic tradition is a world of great certainties. There is God, here are largely his teachings. Whereas one of the things I love about the Rig Vedas is the very first Rig Veda, which is the Rig Veda of creation. And it ends, at the very end, it says, "So how did this all come about and why? Who knows? Only the gods know." And then the final line of this poem, written probably 3,500 BC, is, "And maybe they don't either."
That is so very Hinduism.
When you're dealing with that freedom to recognize that actually it's largely in the mind, and it's largely in the story that you decide to tell, you're coming at things from a very different perspective. So for example, for quite a long time, we had a real problem with fundamentalist evangelicals who felt that the Bible, Book of Revelation, told you how the world would end. A third of the waters would be undrinkable, a third of the air would be unbreathable, the forests would be burnt up, and the sky would go dark, and all food would be poisoned.
We have achieved most of these.
Absolutely. Already. And their point was, if the environmental movement tries to stop this, they're stopping the coming back of Christ. So that view at one level. And on another level, we had within certain forms of Buddhism, but this world isn't real. Why are you worrying? And also, you know, this is the end of a particular, within Hinduism, this is the end of a particular kalpa, a period of time. We are in the degenerate period of that time. This will lead to the entire universe exploding and imploding. Shiva will wrap it up. It will be destroyed. Then will be a long period of absolute silence, and then once again life will come out of the very navel of Brahma, and the worlds, the universes, will start again. And I love the fact that within Hinduism, when they look at the theory of evolution, they go, "Well, that's very sweet. You think we've been around for 4,500 million years as a planet? Oh, for goodness sake. No, we've been around for as many years as there are grains of sands on the banks of the river Ganges, and this is only one of 10,000 worlds that have existed and of 10 billion worlds that will exist. So really, what are you worrying about? You know, seriously, what are you worrying about? So on both levels, you have groups that, in a sense, through their spirituality, said, not our concern. But what I've watched, and I've been at this work now for nearly 40 years, is that as we've begun to explore with them what their real, what the core of their teachings are and our place within those teachings, the biblical fundamentalists have now become very active on what they call creation care. They say, yes, oh my God, we have a responsibility by God. What have we been doing? You know, surely the book of Revelation is a vision of when it's all gone wrong, not how it should end. And you have with the Buddhists and those groups who are sort of saying it's all an illusion, it doesn't really matter, and been around for tens of billions of years, is saying, yes, but this may be the age of decadence, it may be the age of the fading away of true spirituality, and but we cannot be the instruments of that. Mm-hmm. And even within that, particularly in Buddhism, we are called fundamentally to compassion. Yep. So very, very different reasons. Very different reasons, but it brings them to the same place, that on separate journeys. And one of the problems with many groups is that they want all the religions to say one thing. The moment you do that, you've lost 99.999% of people's interest. People, reason we belong to a faith is because it gives us a sense that there is a wisdom that we are heirs to. And what we want is to be asked to share that, not to abandon it in order to take on some kind of vaguely secular universal creed that doesn't speak to our actual culture, our history, our families, our heritage.
I think I asked for an inspiring preach at the beginning. I got it.
Well, you did ask, you know, basically, what is the impact of this?
You know, we are kind of magnetized. We are listening, about the world. It's all much bigger than just impact.
And for a meantime, I forgot that we are on a TV show. I was completely engrossed in your statements.
Very intelligent. You're very kind.
Time flies with you, Martin. Yeah. So let's take some questions from the audience. Ben, you want to take the first one?
So there's one asking a very insightful conversation about faith and how to manage funds for humanity. What do you think about global citizens and funds for the future communities?
Very interesting. I think global citizens, yeah, that's lovely, but actually we are primarily citizens of where we live and of our families and where they live. And I think if we forget that, and if we just say we got to think big, it's the old adage, you know, think global, act locally. That for me works. I worry when, in a sense, we're almost told being global is more important than being local. The one thing we've learned from lockdown is how utterly dependent we are on the local. It's not being the global that's helped us. It has at the scientific level, but not at the local level at all. Funds for the future communities. One of the really interesting developments out of the discussions with the World Bank is a beginning of a notion that we might actually create religious development banks or religious development funds that would actually collectively bring together, say, the key funds within within Hinduism, or the key funds within Protestant churches or the Catholic Church or other such groups, and would actually say, rather than doing this all in piecemeal, if we share common beliefs, great faiths, and we can find a structure that gives us the sense that our billion is considered as important as the 30 billion, or our 2 million is considered as important as the 1 billion, maybe we could be more effective if we created a global fund based on religious principles that would then act as an investing way. So a very simple example with Christianity, the world's largest, wealthiest, most diverse development agency, NGO, is World Vision. It's Evangelical Christians. It's the largest organization in the world. And we're in discussion with them and others to see whether, if they and the other major Protestant portfolios, but also development agencies, if they came together and created a faith development fund or development bank. What an impact that would
have. And I even already know how we can do that, because we have a second question proposing how can we organize a global religious congress and discuss about best practices for World People Funds. So then basically getting into action, you know, so making the huge awareness around the globe, getting together and making this fund which you're talking about possible.
Well,
and we can help you with that.
Well, I would be delighted. That is precisely why Faith Invest exists, in order to enable that dialogue, but also to not just enable a dialogue. Dialogue is very cheap. What we want is actual structural shifting of funds. Without that, this is very nice, but it's basically, you know, painting the deck chairs on the Titanic, not even rearranging them, you know, just painting the backs of them. So we are creating, it'll go live in about a 2 months' time, we're creating a members portal on Faith Invest so that those groups that have joined can actually start sharing best practice, can share examples, to whom we can then bring to the investors platform, the pipeline of projects from around the world. At the same time, we are working, for example, 2022 in Stockholm will be the Stockholm 50 plus event. 50 years ago in 1972, the UN held its first ever conference on the environment in Stockholm. Mm-hmm. And it launched the modern environmental development world. And we are working with the major agencies there to bring the major faiths there, that there'll probably be 1,400 or more that will have made long-term plans, 7 to 10 year plans for implementing environmental policy and development policies to every aspect of their lives. We will launch the details there, and that effectively will be a global religious congress on not what ought to be done, but on what is being done. Mm-hmm. In partnership with some of the major secular agencies who now very much want to be partners with us. So yes, I would say watch the Faith Invest website, faithinvest.org, for details as it grows. But yeah, this is a major element of what we're doing, and not just on climate change and not just on food or energy or on biodiversity. We're basically saying there needs to be, and we can help enable a movement that essentially is about not dealing with the symptoms of the problem. Climate change is not them. It's a symptom of the problem. The problem is we are completely out of relationship with the rest of the planet, as well as vast launches of the rest of the people. We're out of relationship with the law. We're out of, you know, if you look at one thing that my sister, one of my sisters, was a matron, a nurse, for 25 years, and she went straight back into helping once COVID came. She never earned even a tenth of the average bonus that was paid to bankers. Mm-hmm. Are they any use to us in this crisis, the bankers?
No. Martin, you're getting personal now.
Yeah, so we, you know, we've got it so screwed. That's what we've got to be addressing. It's not just about how we make more money go to better places, it's about how we make the money.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then I'd like to come, because you just mentioned about a Faith Invest.
So maybe, Ben, because it was not completely clear, are we now going to organize a global religious congress, yes or no? Maybe in 18 months, you know, it takes usually 18 months to convince them. Maybe next year, 2022, we should do something like that.
We are planning a major event in Stockholm in June 2022.
Okay.
In partnership with all the major development agencies from around the world to celebrate Stockholm 50. But at the same time, we have smaller events, for example, in Asia. We're working in partnership with the wonderful Munakata Shrine, one of the two imperial shrines in Japan, for a major event looking at Asian faiths and their investment policies, their land holdings, et cetera, et cetera. So there are continuous events going on. But the core of it is, it's all very, and we don't bring together religious leaders. Religious leaders have no idea where their money is. Lou, that's my archbishop where the money is. He wouldn't have a clue, bless me. I mean, he's very nice, but he wouldn't have a clue. No point bringing Dalai Lamas to these events. They don't know where he is, and as a Buddhist, he isn't allowed to touch money anyway. We bring the fund managers together. We bring the heads of education. We bring the heads of youth work. We bring the heads of women's organizations. That's what we work with. We work with the actual deliverable structures of the faith, not with the razzmatazz of you know, a photo opportunity with the Pope or the Dalai Lama or whoever it is. They are ultimately only as good as the empowerment they give to the people who actually manage the resources of the faith. Those are the ones we work with.
Yeah, that's very, very important.
Ben, I interrupted you, sorry.
But I like the part about the celebration. So Martin, we can skip the whole event, but we will join the celebration. Is that okay?
You'll be very welcome, Ben, and the charges will be fairly reasonable. And I thought, you know, if you sold your house, you'd probably be able to afford a ticket, but that's fine. We'll let you in.
The question I wanted to ask, which Svetlana stopped me as usual, is that faith-based investment be considered a niche, or can it be considered as a niche in the field of impact investment? For example, how does the use of ethics to guide investment decisions determine impact, especially when faith-based ethical criteria is among the faiths? For example, the Islamic financial system bans interest on investment and aims at enhancing fairness of the good of the society as whole. Or Jainism does not ban interest, but strictly abides by the principle of nonviolence by operating investment choices. So does this different criteria meet at a common ground? Because you have the most experience on this, working with all the different religious sectors.
They meet on the ground that finances are energy, and that energy needs to be used rightly. I think we discussed this last time. So let me take a very simple example. You talked about the Jains, and you talked about the Islamic Bank, a ban on usury. We're in the process of working with the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies on reviving something that they started work on about 12 years ago, but it never quite worked, which is an Ahimsa index.
Nonviolence.
And an Ahimsa, exactly, a nonviolence index, specifically drawing upon Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist teachings. So at the moment, there is a real feeling amongst our Jain, Hindu, and Buddhist groups that they have to conform to certain norms in order to be able to invest, and that many of those norms do not accurately reflect their core values, their core beliefs. So we have a working group at the moment that will probably within the next 6 months develop and launch. I'm not in charge of that group. I get their reports, but they're working hard. An Ahimsa index. Now that Ahimsa index would be of no interest, really, to an Islamic fund, because the Islamic fund has Sharia law. So what we're looking at is, in a sense, saying, okay, where you've got codes, how are they working? And as I mentioned, it was only in 1973 that the first truly Islamic bank was started, and that was the Dubai Islamic Bank. It's now spread. It's one of the largest phenomenons in the economic world. But it's largely been passive. It's not invested in things. It's not been proactive. We're looking to shift that. The Ahimsa index, we hope, will have a similar impact. It will provide a home for those who hold those values. And into that, for example, we might bring the Vegan index, which was launched last year. Fascinating, fascinating program.
But where is it launched now? Is it available for public?
And I'm trying to remember what the correct title of it is. But if you look up Vegan index, I can try and send you the details. They're a great group and doing some fantastic work.
Our vegan friends watching us.
Yeah, well, exactly, which there I'm sure many. I hope so, anyway. So, Ben, in a sense, what we need are instruments that enable this quantitative shift. Is it impact investing niche? No. Impact investing is a niche within our work because many of our faiths are not going down the path of, oh, well, we've put 1% into impact investing. Aren't we good? Isn't this amazing? How successful we've been. I mean, frankly, it's in our in we had a whole revolution in Christianity in the 16th century against the sale of indulgences, and a lot of impact investing, a lot of carbon trading is the sale of indulgences. Look what I've done that's good. Just please don't look at where I've got the other 99%. Many of our groups are saying we want to shift our entire portfolio over a 15-20 year program. There's a wonderful Buddhist community, very wealthy Buddhist community in Japan. They've been doing this for 10 years. Their plan is over 20 years, they will shift all their investments into faith consistent investing, not just an impact package. That's impact, I think, runs the risk of becoming an excuse not to do a lot more.
Mm-hmm. No, that I understand. Mm-hmm. But what do you mean by you mentioned vegan index and ahimsa index? What do you mean by ahimsa index?
An ahimsa index would be an index of companies that would meet a set of criteria that would mean that if you are wanting to invest as someone for whom veganism is either a religious or a moral or a philosophical or spiritual tradition, you could go to this index and the index would say, these are the groups who abide by the principles of this index. I do apologize. I can't quite remember the official title, but I'm sure if you look up vegan, and certainly the people in charge of it are, I think, fascinating group. But we're also working on an ethical banking index, as well as faith consistent. Yeah, it's quite short.
Do you have anybody on that list?
Well, no, not at the moment. I think the answer, Ben. Ethical banking. There was one other I was going to mention. It's gone out of my head now. But what we're also doing is creating an index of fund managers who are willing to be given and follow faith-consistent regulations, because on the whole, the vast majority don't. And so we have to actually create. We're creating the clientele. We also need the managers, and that's a project as well.
Exactly.
That's great. Martin, we are running out of time. Do you have a question to us, maybe?
When Oh, I don't get a check. Oh, what a shame. No, I suppose my main question is, how do we, you raise the issue of groups that lose their way, that become so big they forget why they were set up and the values that they had. I would love to know what the experience of your network is on tackling those kind of issues. The temptation when you're very successful to sell out to a group that claims it will respect your values, and you know damn well they don't. Almost, I wonder if we need a kind of structure that supports groups that are in danger of losing why they came into being. I think that would be an amazing achievement.
Ben, I think
we all come down to one basic rule is greed. That's something which has been such a powerful moving criteria the last, I think, century or something, that even though we do something very good and we become very successful, then somewhere down the path, greed takes over. And then we lose the idea, the ethics where we started from, and divert. And I think there the faith is extremely important. I think, like you say, the shepherd, that's at least somebody who walks next to you and keeps you aware of that, please don't diverge out of your path. Absolutely. Because we humans, at the end of the day, are default. We are by defaulted criteria. So the moment we don't have anybody to guide us or anybody to walk next to us, I think we have a tendency of following our basic instinct, and where greed plays a very, very powerful role.
Absolutely.
I think that's where you are doing an amazing job, because the faiths are the ones who can. I mean, I'm not a very religious person. I'm not saying just because I'm
even though they're also greedy faith driven people.
It's everywhere. None of that.
It's everywhere. So it's
that's human.
But if you're not careful, you kind of go, therefore it can't be stopped.
Yeah, exactly. So we do have a lot of quite a lot of information on these kind of organizations which kind of lost their value or lost their path. And it was, and greed doesn't only have to be about money. Greed can also be for power. Greed can also be for influence. Greed can be for many different reasons. And that is something I think we all should every day wake up and ask ourselves. Doesn't matter whether I'm Bill Gates or doesn't matter whether I'm the poorest man on earth, that am I on my path?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely.
And I think we should also remember that you never know when this life will end, you know. You were quoting Vedas. There is also in Russian literature, amazing writer Mikhail Bulgakov, who wrote Master and Margarita. I don't know if you read that. And Volant was saying that, of course, humans are mortal. But the trick is that you don't even know that is that we are suddenly mortal. So you don't even know if you are having your dinner tonight. Yes. Right. So this is a tricky thing. Okay, we are mortal, but we don't know when. So I suggest everyone to get in action and live these days also with this awareness of our own mortality and our part being part of the nature, realizing that, right? We are guests on this planet and not the most intelligent ones, I would say.
No, I could agree with you. As it says, as Christ said, you know, live each day as though it was your last.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think, Svetlana, you also say something like that.
Right. So you also, if you are on both like spiritual parts and material world, you should live your day as if it would be your last. But then you practice much more spiritual things than caring about material stuff. So,
yeah,
absolutely right.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martin, for joining us today. It's really great having you again with us.
Thank you.
And hope to see you on one of the summits next year.
Yeah. I hope so too. We'll be looking out for each other. Take care. God bless.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So, Svetlana, you're on mute. We can't hear you.
Before we end, I'd like to just quickly mention the course, right? The 18th of March. Don't forget to go to chamomile.ch events and get your seat. And very excited to announce the next guest of the week. It is Kevin Harrington, who is a serial entrepreneur, investor, inventor, and he is original shark from ABC Shark Tank. So he will tell us about how he looks into businesses and projects he invests in. Don't miss this opportunity and join us next Friday.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's a privilege to listen to him because he's a very, very unique and strong personality, especially in the field of investment and businesses. So see you all next Friday.
Act with impact. See you next Friday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.